Broadcast of the Economic Club of Indiana Speaker Series is made possible in part by ProLiance Energy. ProLiance, adding power to energy. Information is at ProLiance.com.
The opinions and commentary expressed in the following presentation do not reflect the views of this station, the Economic Club of Indiana, or the Economic Club's agents or sponsors. Welcome to the Economic Club of Indiana. Today's speaker is World Bank President Robert Zoellick. He says Indiana is an important contributor to the U.S. export business, and the more foreign countries expand, so too do exports.
I really want to thank all of you for coming. This is a tremendous group, and I'm very touched by your interest. I want to thank my friend and former colleague, Governor Mitch Daniels. We had a chance to work together in many capacities over the years. I've got great admiration for his work. I consider him a friend as well as a very effective leader. I'm delighted he's been such a successful governor in the state of Indiana. Being both from the Midwest, we had a slightly different perspective in President Bush's cabinet, because when I grew up in Illinois, we considered Indiana to be an East Coast state. So took a slightly different reorientation. I think, though, perhaps the best comment I can say about Mitch's work is, you know, I sometimes try to read the speeches of some public officials because they often have something interesting to say. Mitch has fallen in that category, but the real reason that I like to read them is that he's got the best assembly of jokes that you can use in speeches of any public official I know. So I always comb his speeches for good jokes, but I can't use them here because he's obviously had them. So,
so. Well, then I'd like to ask you, how in the world did a boy from Naperville set off on this course of education and experience and service that led you to the podium today?
Well, that's starting to harken a ways back, so it's a little harder to recall. But I grew up in Naperville, and I was born in 1953, and my father had served in both World War II and Korea. And I think the reason that was significant is that I had a lot of surplus Army goods around growing up. And so I developed an interest, particularly in history. I've always loved history. Couldn't make a living at it, so I had to try to do some other things. But particularly military history. But then, you know, you grow up and you start to read about other places, and it's been a wonderful foundation, frankly, for the work I've done since then, because particularly as an American working abroad, I found that other countries have a particular appreciation if you know a little bit about their background, enough to at least ask some questions. You keep accumulating and learning as you go. And then, you know, I get in a somewhat haphazard fashion, I guess, developed a multidisciplinary approach. I went out east to college and studied history and economics. Then I did law and public policy degrees. Then I realized that economics wasn't the same as finance, so I tried to learn something about finance and organizational issues. And so, in a way, my career has been an effort to try to combine different skills with a certain skeptical eye about recognizing that different specialties can bring useful perspectives, but sometimes it's useful to look across them and ask questions that you might not feel if you were just in one stovepipe area. So, as you mentioned, I've had the good fortune to work for some wonderful bosses. James Baker, in particular, was Secretary of Treasury, Secretary of State. I was working for Secretary Baker at the end of the Cold War, when he was the senior person on German unification and the negotiation, you know, so that's the serendipity of life. Felt that then since then, as actually the governor and I were talking a little bit yesterday, sometimes a lot of people in the international relations field come simply from the security side, and I've been able to do a little bit from the security and the economics as well, which I think gives you a different perspective.
Terrific. One of the questions from the audience, one of our students from Franklin, asks, what role, if any, do you feel the World Bank has in leading the world out of economic crisis? And with whom, if anyone else, should the World Bank collaborate in that effort?
Well, let me just take a few minutes and explain, because you may have different levels of familiarity with the World Bank group. And in some ways, the comment to the first question is a good foundation. The World Bank was created by really the United States and Britain, some 40 other countries, in 1944, just as World War II was ending. There was a meeting at Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, where the countries that thought they were likely to prevail in World War II said, well, we have to learn the lessons of the failures after World War I. And one of those failures was the breakdown of the world economy that led to the Great Depression and protectionism. And so they tried to create institutions that would learn the lessons of the past. And they sponsored three. One was the IMF, which you read about in the papers, which is the International Monetary Fund. That was to deal with monetary affairs and currency. The second was the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, the World Bank. But that name was important because the first mission really was to focus on the reconstruction of Europe and Japan. If you think about it, in 1945, most of the developing countries of today, or many of them, were still colonies. So the development agenda was very different. And then there was something called the International Trade Organization, which faded into history because the Senate didn't ratify it. But there was a second best, something called GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, which was then used over the course of 40 years until the world again created the World Trade Organization, in a sense a second bite at the apple, to try to deal with the openness of markets. Now, the World Bank, and this is in a sense part of my challenge today, if you think about a multilateral institution created in one era, you know, the times have changed enormously, and the World Bank has to evolve and change with the times. The IBRD point is capitalized by now 179 countries. The United States owns 15% of the capital. We borrow money in markets, a little bit over treasury rates, and do long-term investments working through the public sector and governments. But in the 1950s, President Eisenhower came up with the idea that there should also be support for the private sectors. So we have another part of the World Bank group called the International Finance Corporation, which also borrows in markets but invests in the private sector in developing countries, where we actually try to target the investments to have a greater effect in building different capacities, particularly in poorer countries. Then in the 1960s, there was the idea that there needed to be a particular focus on the poorest countries. That number changes over time. Now it's about 79 countries that are ones that basically have about $1,000 a year per capita income. That's called IDA, the International Development Association. And that gives grants or very long-term loans without interest to those countries. And because of that financing mechanism, unlike the first two, we have to replenish it every 3 years, although we do have flowbacks. In the 80s, there was something created called the MIGA, the Multilateral International Guarantee Association, which does political risk insurance. And then there's a fifth component that's a little bit on the side, which is called ICSID, but some of you in the business community may have heard about this. It does the international arbitration of disputes. So that's, in a sense, the structure of this institution. But, of course, it's had to change and evolve as the international market changes. And to connect to this question, one of the things that is now extremely different about this financial crisis from the ones that many of you either read about or dealt with in the course of the 90s, were those were crises that started in the developing world. Remember East Asia and Thailand and then in Latin America and then going on to Russia. This is one that started in the developed world. And in fact, the developing world has come back relatively well. And we now have, in a sense, a multi-speed recovery. And about half of global growth comes from the developing world. Now, for the role of the World Bank Group, we fortunately came in a very sound position and were able to expand our activities to deal with the downturn for a lot of these countries. And we've committed since July 2008 about $145 billion worth of investments, dispersed about $94 billion across those different categories, some for the poorest, the private sector, and then the basic financing. That's important for the developed world, too, because a lot of that growth then ends up buying exports or for the infrastructure development coming back to the developed world. But in addition to financing, and this is a core point about the bank group, those numbers on the one hand sound pretty big, but if you think about the size of international markets, they're actually a modest amount. So what we really try to do is combine knowledge and learning and experience with the financing to have a bigger policy effect. So in this financial crisis, we tried to go back and look at some of the lessons of the 1990s. And just to highlight a couple that we focused on. One, what you saw in the 1990s with some of the stabilization programs is that stabilization wasn't enough. If you cut the budget so badly that kids lost basic nutrition or kids were forced out of school, you frankly could lose a generation. So we tried to take some lessons about targeted and effective safety net programs. And here again, Governor and I were talking about this a little bit last night. There's actually some things the rest of the developed world can learn from the developing world. There's a program in Mexico called Oportunidades. It's a conditional cash transfer program. It's about a half of 1% of GDP is their social welfare program. But it not only provides money to the poorest, but the conditions are you got to send your kids to school, people have to get health checkups. And it probably has done more for women's health than anything in the history of Mexico. Well, we've been able to expand that model to about 44 or 45 different countries. Some poor countries in Africa that didn't have the capacity, there we'd work with partners like the World Food Program on school feeding or food for work programs or others. A second learning experience was infrastructure. What we saw in the 90s was China, when the downturn occurred, put a lot of money in infrastructure to create jobs, but also future productivity and growth. And for some of you that visited China, you see the expressways, the ports, the airports. You know, it has a huge increase in productivity basis. Another area was the focus on the private sector. And so trying to use some financial innovation, you know, just as you actually see the discussion in the United States, we knew that the public response at some point would have to hand off to the private sector. So what could we do to help strengthen the basis of the private sector in these countries? And one of the most interesting things that we've created in my tenure was we created an asset management corporation within IFC to come up with a different model of financial intermediation. And in effect, as opposed to borrowing the money, making investments, we went to a number of sovereign wealth funds and we've created, for example, a $1 billion equity fund to invest in sub-Saharan Africa, some in Latin America, that would, in a sense, build off our record of returns in IFC's investment that are a shade under 20% over 20 years. And this draws pension funds, sovereign funds. And just to give you a little flavor, it's a comment about what's changing in the world. When I talked to the head of the Dutch pension fund that invested, and I said, now what's drawn you to this? And they said, well, we understand developed markets are risky too. Long-term growth is probably going to come from a lot of these countries, but we as investors really don't know where to go there. The information costs, the transactions costs are high. IFC has developed this capability over the course of 20 years, so really they co-invest with us and we create different structures. This is partly, if you think about it, changing the whole notion of development or foreign assistance. This isn't charity, it's a business investment, but it also recognizes some of the changes in the world economy. And it also means as an institution, we're changing how we do business. So to come back to the point, I think, you know, one of the issues now the world has to face is the complexity of this multi-speed recovery. The Chinas and the Indias, if you read in the newspaper, are actually grown so fast, they're going to have to put on some of the brakes while you have the United States and Japan and Europe still struggling. And that, of course, creates tensions in the international economic environment.
Thank you. Having just described the World Bank and its structure a bit, there are several questions that are curious in different specificity about how the organization is managed and structured, a fairly technical question that you're familiar with, whether it's rebalancing voting weights in the World Bank to reflect the growing power of emerging markets, or the question about who appoints the president of the World Bank.
Well, because it's a public international institution, as I mentioned, we have 100 and I guess I'm sorry, it's 187 shareholders, 187 shareholders, and they are represented by board members, and the board members either represent one country, as in the case of the United States and France and Germany, or they represent constituencies. So we have 25 different board members. This is one of the aspects of the institution that was designed before air travel. What I mean about that is I have an on-site board of 24 board members that have staff. And in effect, it's not a board in the traditional corporate way. It's a form of a parliament, it's a form of a multilateral diplomacy, and it's in a form of a board. And it's one of the challenges for my role is you need to work with that group and the staff, but many of the decisions, the key decisions, are going to still be done in Capitol. So at the same time, I need to work with the heads of government of the ministries. Now, one of the changes, trying to reflect the changing world, is we felt the Africans were underrepresented on that board. So the reason we now have 25 board members is we added another one for sub-Saharan Africa. The countries have votes based on their investments. So it's not one country, one vote. It's based, the United States has about 15% of the votes. And one of the issues has been a better rebalancing of the votes between developing and developed countries. In practical terms, we don't usually take votes, so this is more of a symbolic aspect than it is a practical day-to-day. But I've had to work very hard over the past couple years to reshape this, so now the developing and transition countries, those are some of the countries that came out of the old communist system, represent about 47% of the votes. Another core issue, and this is one that's more directly within my purview, is the staff. Now, we've got a staff that probably comes from about 150 different countries. That's a challenge managerially, but it also is an asset because you have people that bring different perspectives but are brought together with a common mission. One of the things I've tried to do is bring in more people from developing countries to the senior positions. So at the level right below mine, the managing director, one is a former Nigerian finance and foreign minister who made a real great reputation against corruption, a woman, I might add. A second one is, that's Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala. A second is Sri Mulyani Indrawati, who was extremely well-regarded finance minister of Indonesia. And the third is Mohammed Muhyiddin, who is, again, a very strong reformer minister of investment in Egypt. And for the first time, our chief economist comes from the developing world, Justin Lin from China. So that level is all from the developing world. Now, you mentioned about the president, and this is one of those sensitive issues for the future. I mentioned about the IMF and the World Bank. Well, the IMF has always been run by a European, and the current European is a Frenchman, former finance minister named Dominique Strauss-Kahn. The U.S. has always had the appointment for the World Bank. Now, this part of this, there's an understanding between the United States and the Europeans given the votes. The United States has 15% of the votes. Not surprisingly, many people say, well, why should the United States and Europe continue to be the ones that control these posts? Should you open it up to others? This is obviously, in some ways, a very logical point. I'm trying to address it myself with some of the appointments throughout the bank. But I personally have a view on this that's a little different than the norm, and it's not always the most popular one, but I'll explain to this audience why. Number one, sometimes when people say, well, Americans should no longer run the World Bank, I always point out, well, I hope we're not excluding Americans, because sometimes then they assume once an American is out, then it should never be an American. Now, having dealt with international diplomacy and institutions for a while, I assure you there's politics involved with a lot of these decisions. I have never seen a UN Secretary General from the United States. And so, frankly, as someone who spent a lot of time working on issues within the United States but also internationally, I think it's good that the United States is deeply engaged with these multilateral institutions. This isn't always a popular issue. Sometimes you have to work pretty hard on these issues with Congress and other groups. And so I sometimes caution people to be careful about what they wish for, because I frankly think that having an American have some of these responsibilities and have to carry some of the load is good for the international community as well as good for the United States. But this is going to be a decision that, in a sense, is above my pay grade. It'll be made by the shareholders.
Thank you. If I might, I'd like to switch to a series of questions, all of which are sort of policy questions in different areas, and I'll because we're getting a whole range of those. And one begins with asking your opinion about the Federal Reserve's monetary policy. In this case, student says, following the Bank of Japan's policy for the past 20 years. What do you think about the Fed's policy? The policy in Japan never stimulated the economy. Appreciate your advice.
You know, when I served in the Treasury and other posts, I was always trained never to comment on the Federal Reserve. It's a little hard to shake that one. Not sure that it's wise to do so today. But I'll make this comment. Both internationally and domestically, this is still a very sensitive time. I mean, the good news is we've got a recovery. The bad news is it's much slower than we would like. My concern is likely to maintain relatively too high unemployment, and that's going to have all sorts of other implications. So I understand why the Federal Reserve is trying to look at every potential tool, and I'm not on the inside to make the judgment. On the other hand, you know, I think one of the issues that the economics profession is struggling with is a lot of the discussion you hear with the Federal Reserve, or when you hear about fiscal policy or Keynesian policies, is the macroeconomic discussion. Because I've studied a lot of economics, but I don't claim to be a PhD expert, I've sort of tried to come up with some of my own thinking about the connection between the macro and the micro side. Micro side being a lot of the structural aspects important for basis for future growth. If you look at the U.S. private sector, you've got relatively good conditions. You've got balance sheets with about $2 trillion of cash, pretty good productivity, recently pretty good profits, and some signs of people wanting to get back and invest at a larger level. But I'm sure this is the case for some of you here. When I talk with business executives, a lot of whom I had very close contact with from my days as trade representative, there's sort of this pall of uncertainty. You know, what's the future tax situation going to be? What's the healthcare cost? What's different regulation? You know, are we going to get into protectionism and issues? And the connection to the Fed is, I think there's still some uncertainty then about what the benefits of this will be versus the costs of in a sense, using dollars to buy debt. And I don't, again, want to today, you know, sort of say that, you know, one is right or wrong, but I think that effect on uncertainty of the Fed's policies also needs to be weighed in as they go forward.
Following up, actually, just where you were speaking, several questions are asking about trade. Notice that you had that experience, and are also asking along the lines of the role of protectionism, the controversies related to undercutting prices. There's a question about China and machine tools. And a series of issues that I think are around that, what you see the vision for the future of trade in this kind of transitional economy with a series of trade policies you're familiar with.
Well, it's a broad topic. Let me take a cut at it from a couple of different dimensions. All countries face the pressures, particularly when economic times are bad or trying to close down. But I started out talking about lessons from the 30s, and one of the disastrous experiences of the 30s was protectionism. The good news is I think the world has avoided, by and large, a large protectionist swing, but it's obviously made it harder to open markets. From the perspective of the United States, we're about 4% of the world's people, still have maybe 20 to 25% of the world's GDP. But just take what I mentioned about sources of growth. U.S. economy certainly creates some pretty impressive markets, but a lot of the growth, in fact, now the greatest amount of import growth is coming from the developing world. So, and U.S. barriers are actually relatively low compared to others. So one of the points when I spent a lot of time negotiating free trade agreements was we could actually bring down other barriers compared to the United States. Indiana, like Illinois, is a farm state. Well, if you look at farm prices and you look at farm profits, you wouldn't have those profits if you didn't have the type of sales that you have abroad. Now, at the same time, it creates competition. And sometimes people are afraid of competition, whether they think it's fair or it's unfair. If you've looked at a lot of U.S. industries, whether service or manufacturing, they clearly have to change how they've been able to do business and compete over time. Sometimes that, if it's effective, increases productivity. Productivity may mean they need less workers, as you've seen in the manufacturing sector. And then the question is, can a dynamic open economy create other jobs? One of the few benefits of being older is I've lived through some of this. In the 1980s, there was a big worry about this. And people said, well, gee, where are the new jobs going to come from? Well, in the 1980s, I didn't know about something called the Internet, and I couldn't have talked about Google, and I couldn't have talked about iPads. But if you keep an open, dynamic economy, frankly, it's your best chance to have higher incomes and higher performance. Now, there's at the same time, there is an issue about whether trade and exchange rates and issues will be done fairly. And that's partly why you want to have a rules-based system in the international economy. There's another element, though, that I want to touch on from the perspective of the World Bank, because it was also important when I was trade representative. I negotiated a lot of free trade agreements, some with Central America, some with the Arab world, Australia, some of the countries in East Asia, Latin America. And while the markets weren't necessarily big compared to Canada or Europe, these became very important parts of a U.S. agenda to try to shape countries and a rules-based system and open societies to be more congenial with the values and interests of the United States. There were many ministers in developing countries that would say, we got more done through this trade agreement in terms of reforms than we could have got in three different administrations. Because on the trade side, you know, you're not just lowering tariffs. To open up doors for American service industry, you'll often be requiring transparency, type of regulation, so people have to post and take comment on changes in the service sector area. Intellectual property rules. Obviously, we got Eli Lilly here in town. You got a lot of pharmaceutical companies. This is a very important aspect of America's future. But even beyond that, and I'll tell this about the Arab world, you're creating societies where you're trying to encourage the development of openness, middle class, transparency. Now, they're not all going to be democracies, and they're not all going to be exactly like the United States, but no place will be. The question is, do you want to try to move the world in that direction for openness? So I think, you know, one of the challenges, if you look in the discussions in polls or other topics, obviously there's a lot of anxiety about trade and openness. But my own sense, if I look at America's history, is our trump card as a nation has been our openness as a society, an openness to capital, to trade, to goods, to people, to ideas. And if you think about how America's reformed itself over time, any country makes mistakes. Any country needs to retool itself. If you close yourself off, you're much less likely to understand what needs to be done. And even, I'll hand a little bouquet to your governor here, just to give one other example that I see from the developing world. I mentioned infrastructure. The infrastructure needs in energy, transport, water, urbanization in the developing world are huge, probably estimated to be between about $1 trillion and $1.5 trillion a year. And the investments are still in the $800 to $900 billion area, so this is big business. But there's not a developing country with which I work that isn't trying to figure out how to bring private capital into this. And so we, in fact, a couple of weeks ago, I opened up a Center of Excellence for Infrastructure Finance in Singapore that's working all throughout East Asia about designing infrastructure projects where you can bring in private capital. Well, I often point out in some other audiences in the United States, well, we've got some budget and financial problems here, but we also got some assets. Why don't we monetize some of the assets? Now, all of you know probably better than I do the struggle the governor had dealing with the tollway, but if you can take $4 billion and monetize it and put it back into an infrastructure, that's not such a bad idea. Now, other states obviously have had political difficulties in trying to do that. But part of the larger message is if you're open to ideas, why not be trying to understand, in this case, what some of the developing countries are willing to use private capital more than the United States of America is. So there's a two-way lesson here. And, you know, frankly, people can be very proud of the United States as they should be, but I think our greatest source of pride is being open-minded enough to learn from others, too.
Thank you. A question that, building on that, areas of the world that get talked about in several of these questions are interestingly several questions related to the Koreas and probably because of recent events related to North Korea and their neighbor China. And I guess I'd summarize it with a single question. which is what caused the economic boom in China, and is that unique? And then the next follow-on question I want to give you a chance to think about, somebody asked you, could you please enable the two Koreas to unite as you helped the two Germanys? And I want to give you a chance to think about that. How about China first?
Well, China's not such an easy one either. In some ways, the past 30 years in China have been one of the most amazing economic transformations the world has seen. And in terms of overcoming poverty, the growth has probably taken 300, 400, 500 million people out of poverty and created huge opportunity. Now, it started from a pretty bad situation. And many of you know Chinese have a strong sense of history. 20th century wasn't such a good one for them. And so in part because of invasions, in part because of the breakdown of the old empire and the Chinese Republic, and then their own actions. So part of the growth that we've seen, tremendous growth, I think is a function of just sort of creating the basic conditions to start to allow people to get the benefits of their work and use investment and start to bring in and use markets more effectively. Having said that, you know, if you talk, you know, when people often visit China, they go to Beijing or Shanghai. There's still a lot of very poor places in China. Whenever I visit, I always try to get out to see one of the other provinces. This September, I had some business in Beijing and Shanghai, but also went to Guizhou in the south. And, you know, people there are living $500, $600 per capita income, but they're seeing a better future. And so there's a huge energy in China, as throughout all of East Asia, because people are optimistic about building for the future. And that also is a little thought that Americans need to keep in mind. And one little tangent here is last year I attended a G20 finance ministers meeting in Scotland around this time of year, and it was kind of gray November Scottish dour weather, and there were a lot of Europeans that were pretty soulful about the situation. I flew to Singapore for an APEC meeting, Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation. And it just struck me within one plane flight the whole different attitude. In East Asia, people's attitude was, well, we went through this in the 90s. We know we've got to create additional basis for growth. They were talking about deregulating service sector industries to create more jobs and investment opportunities. So part of the story of China in East Asia is a continued desire to build and grow. And this is, again, one of the challenges for the United States is, does it want to be part of this process, or does it want to try to just preserve the past? Now, having said that, China's growth model was the growth model that was used by Japan, Korea, some of the other Southeast Asian countries, Taiwan, which was export-led growth. And I think one of the things that the Chinese are also recognizing now is that a reliance on export-led growth, given its size and its success, has got risks. Will the U.S. consumer and some of the other consumers be able to play that role? This is what you sometimes, when you read in the paper about rebalancing, about demand, sort of some of the issues. And one of the issues now that China will be trying to focus on is the structural changes of its economy. And we could talk a little bit more about that if people want, about not only in terms of providing some of the health and education, other services, but moving to industries that are based more on domestic demand. So that story is far from over. I admire what the Chinese have accomplished, but I'll also say many people here have been in different business or financial situations. You got 10% growth, it hides a lot of problems. So at some time, if growth slows, and growth will slow at some point, there's still a lot of challenges to be dealt with. And if this is the pattern you've seen for other countries in Southeast Asia and others that have followed that strategy. Now, on the Koreas, it's a little bit closer to home than you think. In the 90s, because I was the senior person in the 2+4 negotiations on German unification, I actually had a lot of sessions with the South Koreans about preparing for different circumstances. Each situation is obviously unique, and in effect the sort of extreme poverty and institutional breakdown and cruelty in North Korea is even much worse than you could find in East Germany. And so, remember, in East Germany, people still had West German TV. They had a sense of what the association was. They had a society that had some contact with the modern world economy earlier in the 20th century. North Korea is a totally different situation. But here's, I guess, as a general point, one of the things that I saw in the case of Germany was even after 40 years of the West Germany embedding itself in European institutions and NATO and the Transatlantic Alliance, if you think back 20 years, it was still a very sensitive issue with their European partners. And in fact, many of the European partners said, we like Germany so much we would like two of them as opposed to one. And this, of course, is partly some of the anxieties of history. Germany succeeded in part because it had a good partnership with the United States, but also because it could rely on those institutional and relationships. So Korea, the Republic of Korea, South Korea, is in a slightly different position. It's actually the smaller player in the neighborhood. It's got Japan, it's got China, it's got Russia. But strategically, it would make a lot of sense for South Korea to work closely with its neighbors to try to create an environment where if there is a chance for breakdown and unification, that you can manage the anxieties of the neighbors, because the neighbors can cause a lot of trouble one way or the other. And I think this is the core story for today. Look, the Chinese fought with North Korea in the Korean War. There's still a lot of ties of solidarity. A lot of Chinese, younger Chinese, feel they've got a basket case and that, you know, they're going to have to, they're propping it up and they may not like it. But they're also concerned about cataclysm on their borders. And this is where, again, one of the wonderful things about the United States is people are always looking ahead, so they're not bound by history as in some countries. But it's important to understand how other societies look at these things. And for a lot of the current Chinese leadership, remember, a lot of these people went through the Cultural Revolution, and it was not pleasant. And so their view of turmoil in society is a pretty tough thing, and they don't want that on their borders or certainly in their own country. And so in some ways it makes them more conservative about change than you might have in the United States, because they don't want instability. It frightens them. So I think part of the challenge here is trying to, the best thing that could be done, in my view, is to open up North Korea. And if I were doing a negotiation, if I could see some room to do that, because I think that will drive change. I think the North Koreans are going to try very hard to avoid that. And I think what you've seen the North Koreans do is make weakness into a strength by threatening parties. And I'll just relay, I actually talked to some Chinese officials about this in September, because this was right after the Korean ship had been sunk. My own personal view is it's very critical for everybody, firmly, not hostily, to make it clear, including the Chinese, that those sort of violent actions are unacceptable and they're going to be treated badly. Because if you don't, and I frankly think this is one of the things that happened, I don't think the Chinese sent a strong enough message, then people might do it again, as they did. And this is going to require some careful coordination by the countries in the neighborhood. I think President Lee of South Korea, frankly, in a very difficult situation, has done a very, very good job of trying to balance the sensitivities. But let's connect this back to the economic point. The United States negotiated a free trade agreement with Korea. It's about the 10th largest economy. It certainly is in Korea's interest to have economic ties just like security ties. And in my view, it's also in the United States' interest not only to be the security provider, but also to have the economic connections with Korea. And I might add, after that free trade agreement, it might be interesting to see what could be done with Japan. So one of the challenges, I think, in the system, and in a way, this almost goes back to the U.S. strategy in 45. Remember, you not only had NATO, you had the Marshall Plan. You had economic links with security links. Well, I think we need to, in the 21st century, we need to think about, again, parallel and mutually supportive strategies.
Thank you very much. Perhaps a wrap-up question. One of our audience asked, if countries were stocks, where would you be investing your money today?
Well, you can tell now I am a Midwesterner. I'm still bullish on the United States. And there are going to be some very interesting decisions now coming out with this deficit commission and some of the core issues. And let me just highlight this aspect. I talked a little bit about the aggregate demand issues. One of the points I've tried to emphasize in my writings or remarks is not to lose sight of some of the structural reforms that drive the fundamentals of growth. So these are partly, you know, given the demographics in the United States, at, you know, what our own buildup of debt and deficits is. It's also what your tax policy is. Does the tax policy reward innovation? Does it encourage competitive instincts? And so one of the sort of side benefits of these reports you've seen on deficits that I think is very healthy is the idea that maybe we need to relook at how the tax code works. I worked with Secretary Baker at the time of the 86 tax reform, which was based on the idea of trying to remove special tax benefits. Some people call them tax expenditures. Some of them call them other types of tax entitlements. And then you lower the rates. And this is, I think, a topic that will now be on the national agenda. But I mentioned infrastructure. Look, if you look at the history of the United States, whether it was canals or telegraphs or railroads or, you know, the interstate highway system, which most economists talk about how increased time and movement of goods and productivity, these are also important issues. But how are you going to finance it? And so it would come right back to my point about thinking of some ways of innovative financing. Education systems. I saw a report from a friend at the Tuck School that pointed out that we now have 75% of high school graduates or of people in high school graduate. And this is actually down 2% from 77% in the 60s, and we were at about 70% in 1900. And we can all guess the quality of a high school education in 1900 versus what it is today. How are you going to compete if you got 25% of your people not graduating from high school? And frankly, then you go on to other types of training. Now, it all doesn't have to be one form with different types of technical or college or other types of aspects, but use of community colleges and training. But we as a society, I think, have to face these questions about building the long-term basis of growth and getting the incentives right. But having said that, you know, I would never count out American business and ingenuity. So frankly, you know, I think that the potential for investments in U.S. companies actually is still reasonably good now. Having said that, I'll come back to my point about developing markets. Developing markets are going to be growing. They're going to, you know, continue to be a source of energy. Now, you have to disaggregate, and you have to look at sectors, and you have to understand what you're doing. But what we are trying to do in the World Bank is create a better climate for people to grow and advance those societies at the same time you can bring investment. So I'm not bearish by nature, but on the other hand, having been in public sector and private sector over different years, I keep trying to press forward the questions that I think people have to try to address so we don't take things for granted.
Can we all give a round of applause and thanks? Thank you very, very much. Impressive range of answers to an incredible...
You've been listening to Robert Zoellick, the president of the World Bank, which contributes to the health, education, public, and private development of countries around the world. Indiana Secretary of Commerce Mitch Robe has a keen interest in foreign investors and increasing their attraction to Indiana.
We export an enormous amount of both intellectual property in the form of products and products themselves that are designed other places. The best example of our engagement would be a company like Cummins that's headquartered here, does business around the world, and has recently agreed to hire 300 people in Columbus, Indiana, to create product to be manufactured and sold for the Chinese domestic market. So people look at China as being a great exporter, which it is, but it's also an enormous consumer, right? The size of that consumer marketplace in China and eventually in India will dwarf America's. So there's tremendous opportunity for companies in Indiana to be exporting goods and services to those countries. The United States of America will consume about 11 million vehicles in 2010. The Chinese will consume about 18 million. The automobile industry is a huge part of our agenda in Indiana, both for domestic production and for export. We are not currently producing vehicles that are exported to the Chinese market, but we are designing product here in the United States that is manufactured for the Chinese market. Well, the first draw to Indiana is always our workforce. We have a tremendous workforce that has a reputation of being very hardworking. So as somebody said, Indiana has a Midwestern work ethic with Sunbelt prices. So a tremendous value that you can get here in Indiana. And we also have great infrastructure. If you're going to distribute, if you're going to move that product anywhere in the United States, you can get 80% of the U.S. population inside of a one-day drive from almost any place in Indiana. So terrific infrastructure, great workforce, low cost of doing business. Those are the key factors why people choose to locate here in Indiana. I mean, the one that comes to mind, I was with them yesterday, Toyota, has over 12,000 employees here in the state of Indiana. Tremendous employer. They could choose to do business any place. They've got there are two different Toyota plants here that make Toyota vehicles that you're familiar with, as well as many related companies that do parts supply. They continue to grow their presence. The governor was fortunate enough to visit with Akio Toyota in Tokyo on our most recent visit, and we maintain and cultivate a very warm relationship with all of our foreign nameplated or incorporated companies. Over 148,000 Hoosiers today work for foreign incorporated companies. Well, I would say in general, we're doing better than other states are. Governor Daniels has put a lot of emphasis on reconnecting early on in his tenure with our relationships in Japan and now with China. I'll be going to India shortly. So connecting Indiana to the world and the world to Indiana is really a large part of our economic future. Of the about 200 deals we've done this year, over 30, we competed only with overseas locations. So it's really hard to believe any longer that there are large companies that are American companies or Swiss companies or Japanese companies. They're companies of the world, right? And they're going to choose the best location to invest from a human resource standpoint, the best from a tax standpoint, where they can get the best return on their investment for their shareholders. Mm-hmm. So we need to be about the business of making Indiana a place that people want to keep and bring their personal and financial capital. If you look at the GDP of China, it's exploding. The percentage of GDP of individual income that they spend on healthcare is very low compared to the compared to Europe and certainly compared to the United States. So that number is going to grow. Indiana companies have a tremendous opportunity to grab a rapidly expanding, growing at geometric rates market in China, just as an example.
That was Mitch Robe, Indiana Secretary of Commerce and CEO of the Indiana Economic Development Corporation. Coming up next time on the Economic Club of Indiana, we'll hear from Jamie Marisotis, President and CEO of the Lumina Foundation for Education. Lumina has more than $1 billion in assets and is the nation's largest private organization dedicated to making higher education accessible to more students. The Economic Club of Indiana is a production of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations. Thank you for joining us. I'm Sharon Alseth.
ProLiance Energy, providing natural gas to more than 1,200 commercial, industrial, utility, and municipal customers. ProLiance, adding power to energy. Information is at ProLiance.com.